Thank you for coming today. We're going to begin a study of the book of Judges, which Jeff and I will be team teaching, and we hope to be through the book sometime in the early summer. As you might, this won't surprise anyone if you've been here. I've prepared more material today than I have time to get through. So I know some of you go to this next service, and if that's the case and if we're running over, feel free to get up and leave and you will not hurt my feelings at all. I want to begin today with a couple of scriptures that are not in the book of Judges, but we are going to very quickly get into the text of Judges. But I want to look first at a few verses in the 15th chapter of Genesis, particularly verses 13 through 16. In this chapter, Abram has expressed his faith in Yahweh. God has honored that faith by reckoning righteousness to Abram. Abram is a believer. He's the recipient of promises that God has made, which include the possession of a land and the imminent birth of a son. And in the 13th verse, God begins to explain something to Abram that he had not heretofore understood. I sort of think when Abram walked out of Mesopotamia in response to God's call, that he thought those promises were going to be fulfilled in full in his lifetime. Now, in these verses, God is beginning to explain to Abram that that's not exactly how this is going to work. Verse 13, God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in the land, in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years." And of course, this is a prophetic look forward to the Egyptian captivity, even though the name Egypt doesn't appear. Verse 14, "But I also will judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." So we learn here that God can do more than one thing at a time. He can develop the nation of Israel to be the recipients of his promises, and at the same time, he can judge nations that are in opposition to his character. Verse 15, "As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. Then, in the fourth generation, they shall return here," and here's the phrase I want you to notice, "for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." Amorite is a synonym for Canaanite. They were the largest of the tribes. And so that term is used interchangeably in Scripture. So you may hear the Canaanites referred to as Canaanites. You may hear them referred to as Amorites. And in that case, it's just they're just flipping terms back and forth. Now, over in Deuteronomy chapter 9, we move forward several hundred years. And now Moses is expressing to the Jews who are about to take possession of the land that God had promised to Abram, and he wants to make sure that they understand something. He says in verse 4, "Do not say in your heart, when the Lord your God has driven them out," the antecedent of them is the Canaanite, the Amorite. "Don't think in your heart when God has driven them out before you," quote, "it is because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. No, it's because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is possessing them before you. It's not because of your righteousness or because of the uprightness of your heart that you're going to possess the land, but it's because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God is driving them out before you in order to confirm the oath." These are the Abrahamic promises. "In order to confirm the oath which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Know then, it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stubborn people." So we learn here that, again, God is going to be doing two things in the conquest. He's going to be initiating the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises, but in addition to that, he's going to be bringing judgment on the inhabitants of Canaan. The title of our first lesson in the book of Judges is Incomplete Obedience When Conquest turns to failure. The content of the book of Judges is introduced in verse 1 with a simple phrase. This is what happened after Joshua died. The book of Judges records events that took place after the death of Joshua, and it covers a period of approximately 350 years, probably somewhere from around 1380 BC to 1050 BC. So the book of Judges informs us of Israel's history from the death of Joshua to the rise of the monarchy. Unlike the book of Joshua, which recounts a period in Israel's history largely marked by faithfulness to God, Judges recounts a time characterized for the most part by spiritual weakness and often failure. This is a time of moral and spiritual relativism. If you want to get a sense of what life was like during the period of the Judges, consider Proverbs 14:12. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end of that way is death. I want you to notice how well this assessment of human nature fits with the final verse in the book of Judges. It reads, in those days, that is, in the days between the death of Joshua and the monarchy, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's a dangerous thing to do. The rabbis refer to the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings as the former prophets. They call them this because they record the history of God's faithfulness to his people and to the covenant. They also give tangible historical validation to the warnings regarding disobedience that are recorded for us in the book of Deuteronomy. You know, throughout history, God has been faithful to his word. We'll see in the book of Judges that his word can be a word of blessing. It can also be a word of judgment. In either case, God is faithful to his words. I hope as we study these stories, we'll see this all too familiar parallel between Israel's cycles of faithfulness, drifting away, outright disobedience, judgment, and repentance, and ourselves. Like Israel, our spiritual lives often go through these same cycles, so there's a lot to be learned about ourselves from studying the history of Israel in the time of the Judges. You know, Linda and I enjoyed watching the Winter Olympics this year. You probably watched them some yourself. The athletes come from all over the world. They spend years preparing for their Olympic events. Some of those events are over pretty quickly. Others take longer. But in every case, you can see how fatigue builds and the athletes, as they perform in their chosen sports, except for curling. Does anybody get curling?
You have to be Canadian.
Okay. This may surprise you, but I like ice skating. Can I just admit that? How many men here today are man enough to raise your hand and say, I like ice skating? Okay, a few.
Not figure skating, but ice skating.
Ice skating. I wish I had half the nerve of those girls who allow a man to toss them up in the air, flailing around and twisting and falling around, and they land on 1 foot on a quarter inch wide razor blade on ice. That's not near as forgiving as water. I wish I had that much nerve. I don't. Well, I learned something this year. I learned that as these ice skaters compete, if they perform their jumps in the latter half of the program, they get more points for that. Did you know that? I didn't know that. I learned that this year. The reason is that as they skate, they begin to get tired, and as the exhaustion sets in, the jumps are then harder to complete properly. If you watch the opening ceremonies, you could tell that the athletes arrived in South Korea full of hope, full of anticipation. They wanted to perform well. But exhaustion can turn hope into failure very quickly, as many of these young men and women discovered. Fatigue can lead to failure in more areas of life than athletics, and we're about to see how that happens. The book of Judges begins like The book of Joshua began with the death of a national leader. The death of Moses marked the end of the 40-year wilderness wanderings and the beginning of the conquest period under Joshua. The death of Joshua marked the end of the initial phase of the conquest and the beginning of the settlement period. So when the book of Judges begins, the Israelites are in the promised land, but the people are fatigued from war with the Canaanites under Joshua. They were living in relative peace, and it's easy to become complacent when things are going well. Besides, who wouldn't prefer peace to war? And there was a problem. Israel had not finished the race, if you want to think of the conquest in that way. God gave Joshua and the people a task, and that task had not been completed. Not all of the land of Canaan had been conquered, and not all of the Canaanites had been displaced or destroyed. There was much left to do, and the responsibility of leadership now will fall to Joshua's successors, the men and women the Bible calls the judges. On a positive note, the death of Joshua marked a new beginning and a reason for the Jews to take up arms again and begin to reassert themselves according to the mandate that God had given to them under Moses. At the end of the book of Joshua, just before his death, he gives a speech to the people in chapters 22 through 24 of Joshua, and I hope that perhaps this time you'll find time to read those chapters. It's the last three chapters of the preceding book, the book of Joshua. And in this address, you'll find that famous declaration, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Now, this sounded right to the people. So, following the example of Joshua, Israel made a pledge to be obedient. This then begs the question, what did it mean to be obedient in this context? Well, it involved keeping the Mosaic law, for sure. But it also involved driving the remaining Canaanites out of the land that God had given to Israel. And this is where we begin our study today of the book of Judges. So I want to look at the first two verses of chapter 1. "Now it came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?' And the Lord said, 'Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand.'" Israel had pledged to do a good thing. They were taking up the task of finishing the work of conquering the Canaanites. We'll see here the continuing influence of Joshua in their lives, because they do something here that's quite wise. They inquire of the Lord. They didn't simply pass out swords and spears and go out and start killing people. They could have gone to war based on their own good intentions, and they probably would have failed, but they didn't do this. What they did is they turned to the Lord and they inquired. This means that they prayed. They inquired of the Lord. The question they asked was, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites?" Who's going to lead us? Who's going to take the place of Joshua? What tribe is going to step forward and go up first? Lord, which one have you chosen? So this is the question. The people knew in general what needed to be done, but they weren't quite sure how to go about it. You know, last October, I had an opportunity to meet some friends of mine who live all around the country in Washington, D.C. And one of the things we did was visit the World War II Memorial. I'd never seen it. I've been to Washington many times, but I've never seen the memorial. My dad saw it because, as a World War II vet, he qualified for an honor flight that he took a few years before he died. And of course, they visited the World War II memorial. And he loved it. And so I've wanted to see it ever since then. So we visited the memorial. It's phenomenal. And as you might expect, there are plaques that are posted all around the memorial, primarily containing quotes from famous World War II era personages. One quote that particularly caught my eye was by Harry S. Truman. It's a quote in which he memorializes the contribution of all the Allied forces in defeating the enemy in World War II. And this is the quote. Truman said, "The heroism of our troops was matched by that of the armed forces of the nations that fought by our side. They absorbed blows, and they shared the full in the ultimate destruction of the enemy." I was struck by that phrase, the ultimate destruction of the enemy. Many of the problems that we face today, North Korea being a good example, is a result of failing to understand the significance of that phrase. The ultimate destruction of the Canaanites was a mandate that God had set before Israel. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, and then the verses we read earlier in chapter 9 make this pretty clear. Israel's failure to accomplish this mandate was a snare. It was a trap. It was exactly what Moses said it would be in Deuteronomy 7, verse 16. We're not told exactly how the Israelites asked this question or the means by which the question was answered. I suspect that they inquired of the Lord through the high priest who was in Shechem. During the days of Moses and Joshua, God had communicated directly with Israel's leaders in the tent of meeting. But with the death of Joshua, that didn't occur anymore, at least not frequently. It did occur some, but not frequently. What we began to see was the use of something called the Urim and Thummim that took a more significant role in deciphering God's will. Well, we're not sure exactly what that was. The rabbis think that the high priest had two stones, a white stone and a black stone, that he carried in a pouch. And in some way that we don't fully understand, he could use these stones to determine the will of God, not in every situation, but in some situations. As God began to speak to the people through the prophets, as the scriptures began to be given over progressively over time, and we had the written word of God, the use of the Urim and Thummim sort of fell to the side. I think there's perhaps one reference in Ezra or Nehemiah, and then we don't hear about it anymore. But we should take note here. However the process occurred, we have the same challenges today that the Jewish settlers had. We may very well know what we ought to do, but we don't necessarily know sometimes how to go about it. You want to serve the Lord, but how do you do that? Well, I think before you become a missionary to Nigeria or Nepal or China, inquire of the Lord. In seminary, I thought seriously about joining Wycliffe. I prayed about it. It wasn't what the Lord wanted me to do. So it's important to seek guidance from the Lord, to ask for wisdom from the Lord as James instructs us in James 1:5, and know that God gives it to us generously when we ask. So we should follow the example of these Israelites and never begin an enterprise without spending time in prayer. And of course, the other side of that coin is once you know the will of God, you need to do it. I remember Howard Hendricks saying more than one time, "My problem with the Bible is not the parts I don't understand. My problem is with the parts I do understand and don't do." I think we can all understand that. So there's this thing of determining God's will, and then there's this obedience thing. We're supposed to do it. Here Israel did it. Not every example that Israel sets in the Old Testament is a good one, but this is one that is. And so we should credit them for that. They inquired of the Lord, and the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." God is giving into the hand of Judah the same land he promised to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant. So these battles that we're going to see in the book of Judges are a covenant thing. It's related to certainly judging the Canaanites, but it's also related to the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises. Well, if we read through the Old Testament, we'll notice that, particularly beginning with the book of Exodus through Joshua, that Israel has always had one central leader. But now Moses and Joshua are dead, and the people are unsettled. Moses is gone, Joshua's gone, but God is still sovereign. His plan hasn't changed, and Israel can be confident in him. Because you see, God's plan never has depended on men anyway. Success lies with the Lord alone. Great men come and great men go. We lost a great one on February the 21st this year. Billy Graham is with the Lord. But the gospel he preached is just as powerful today as it was on February the 20th. It hasn't changed. And when we lose great men, God fills the vacuum. God's work never depended on Billy Graham or any other man for that matter. Each of us as servants of the Lord is expendable. And as we mourn the loss of Billy Graham, Israel mourned the loss of Joshua. So maybe this is a good time for us to study this book. You know, I've said and I've heard others say there will never be another Billy Graham. And there never will be. But there will be someone. And as we study the book of Judges, we're going to see that God raises up leader after leader. And it will be the right man or the right woman at the right time, so that his purposes are accomplished and the kingdom of God is advanced. The book of Judges, we're going to learn that God even has the ability to use flawed human beings to accomplish his purpose. Samson is going to be a good example of this. In this life, men will come and men will go. Moses, Joshua, Billy Graham. Generations will come and go, but God doesn't come and go, and his plan doesn't change. God's plan is immutable for one reason. He's immutable. So the message for Israel and for us too is, let not your confidence in God fade. This is why God can say, I've given the land into his hand. By appointing Judah to lead this war effort, God was able to encourage the nation and communicate to the people that the war has resumed. The conquest is on again. This time, at least, there will be a partial fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises. And under the directive of Deuteronomy chapter 7, the people are called upon to fight in order to get rid of the Canaanites. In Genesis 15:16, the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet complete. It had not reached that critical point that would trigger judgment. But now it has. And Israel is the instrument of God's judgment on the inhabitants of Canaan. He says, I've given the land into his hand. There's no question what's about to take place. The battle has not begun, but the outcome of the battle is certain. God has already given victory to Israel. Now, I want you to notice the similarity in Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 24, because there's a promise there that Moses, actually God is giving this promise to the people through Moses, but Moses is speaking. I want you to listen to the words here. He says, every place on which the sole of your foot shall tread shall be yours. Your border shall be from the wilderness of Lebanon, and from the river Euphrates, as far as the western sea, which is the Mediterranean. Then if you look in Joshua, not Judges, but Joshua chapter 1, verse 3, we read, every place on which the sole of your foot treads I have given to you, just as I spoke to Moses. Well, when did God do this? Well, he first said he would do it when he called Abram out of Mesopotamia and had promised him a land. Then he reconfirmed that promise with Isaac and Jacob. And then he repeated it through Moses. And then he said it again through Joshua. But God's plan for Israel was actually determined as part of the divine decree made by the Trinity in eternity past. So there's nothing about God's plan that's at risk. It isn't conditional. God is sovereign. And the sovereignty of God is depicted for us in two ways in these opening verses of Judges. First, by the unconditional promise of victory over Israel's enemies, and by the choice of Judah to lead the war effort. If you were to look back in Genesis 49 at the blessings Jacob offered to his son, we would be particularly struck by his blessing of Judah in verses 8 through 12. In verse 8, Jacob says, Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be upon the neck of your enemies. Now, if I were going to go into battle as an Israelite, I'd want Judah to lead me into battle. I want the the tribe about whom it was said, your hand will be upon the necks of your enemies to lead me. Verse 9, Judah is a young lion, and who dares awaken a lion? And verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Who is it who leads an army into battle? Well, it's the king. And Judah is the tribe of kings, even the tribe of the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. Look at verse 3. Then Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted me, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted you. So Simeon went up with him. The first decision is soon followed by a second decision, the invitation of Simeon to go up with Judah in the battle. Now, if you look back at the history of these tribes' namesakes, Judah and Simeon, they were the full blood brothers born to Jacob by Leah. Beyond this, if you look at a map of how God allocated the promised land to the tribes of Israel, you'll notice that Judah is located in the south of Canaan at the very bottom of the map. And actually, inside Judah's allotment, there's this sort of roundish area that was given to Simeon. Simeon is contained within the borders of Judah. Highland Park, you know where Highland Park is? Highland Park is contained within the physical boundaries of the city of Dallas. This is exactly the relationship between Simeon and Judah. Simeon is Highland Park, and Judah is Dallas proper that surrounds it. So it makes perfect sense for Judah and Simeon to work together in eradicating the Canaanites. They essentially were defending and securing the same territory. Now, the first battle that they engage in, we're told about in verses 4 through 7. Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adonibezek in Bezek, and they fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. But Adonibezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Adonibezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. So they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. Bezek is a place. It's a small village that is located north of Jerusalem in the allocation that was assigned to Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan River. There Judah and Simeon confronted Adonibezek and defeated him and his army. So Bezek is a place, Adonibezek is a person, and if you're interested, Adonibezek is not a name, it's a title. It means the Lord of Bezek. You can think of this guy as both the mayor and the police chief, because he administered the city, but he also had the ability to send forth armed people to fight. It was, in effect, a small army, I guess you could say. So think of him as the mayor and the police chief. Verse 6 is kind of odd. These Judite troops captured him. And in the Hebrew text literally says they cut off the thumbs off his hands and feet. That almost certainly means that they cut off his thumbs and his big toes, since we don't have thumbs on our feet. At least I don't. I don't know if any of you do or not. This is not something Israel did a lot, but it was a practice that was pretty common in the Middle East. And the reason they did it, really a couple of reasons. First, by denying the defeated king the use of his thumbs and toes, he could no longer use a weapon. And as such, he was humiliated, and it lessened his appeal as a leader of any future revolts. Beyond this, what I find interesting is the text offers no comment morally or ethically about this practice. It simply reports it and then leaves any commentary to the victim himself. And even more intriguing is the fact that Adonibezek interprets his own faith theologically. He says, God has repaid me for what I've done. Now, personally, I don't take that too seriously, because he does not say that Yahweh, the God of Israel, has repaid me. He simply says Elohim has repaid me. And all the Canaanites, without exception, were theists. So I think there's a pretty good chance he's simply referring to a Canaanite deity here. Next is the battle for Jerusalem in verse 8. Then the sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword, and they set the city on fire. Now, I don't want you to be confused by this verse. It tells us that the Israelites fought against Jerusalem and burned the city. Now, we're used to thinking of Jerusalem as the center of Jewish life, but you have to remember, this is before Israel had captured Jerusalem. At this time, there's a Canaanite tribe known as the Jebusites who are living in Jerusalem. So geographically, Jerusalem's just across the northern border of Judah in the allocation that was given to Benjamin. It's a very strategic site for the Jews. And so they go in and they fight against the Jebusites who are inhabiting Jerusalem, and they defeat them and they burn the city. Now, I'm going to take 30 seconds and make a little excursus here that has absolutely nothing to do with today's lesson. Nothing. Okay. In this time, the Semitic languages of this period were differentiated geographically. Sumerian and Akkadian were categorized as East Semitic languages. Arabic is South Semitic, with Ethiopic being the Western dialect of South Semitic. And then there are this block of languages called the Northwest Semitic languages. They're also known as the Canaanite languages. These include such languages as Aramaic, Syriac, Phoenician, Punic, Hittite, Ugaritic, Amorite, Moabite, Edomite, and Jebusite. I mention this because it is the Jebusite dialect, the dialect spoken in Jerusalem by the Jebusites, that developed into what we know today as Hebrew. So I told you it has nothing whatsoever to do with the lesson. I think it's interesting, and I hope you do too. Back to Judges 1:8. The Judeans defeated and burned Jerusalem. This is in accordance to the mandate given to Joshua that was mentioned earlier. But despite this, apparently, I mean, I'm kind of reading between the lines here, but apparently the Israelites were in some way falling short of complete destruction of these conquered cities. Their mandate was to conquer the cities and destroy man, woman, and beast. And somewhere along the lines, they're not doing this. This shortcoming, you're going to see, is going to become a pattern that we're going to see throughout the book of Judges. Israel will conquer a city, but they were not doing what God had commanded them to do, which was to completely eradicate the Canaanites from the land. Partial victories allowed the enemy to recover, regroup, rearm, reengage Israel, and after they had regained some of their military strength, they had to be dealt with yet once again. Israel is guilty here of incomplete obedience, and it is this incomplete obedience that will turn conquest into failure. Verse 9 records the introductory statement for the battles in the hill country, the Negev and the Shephelah, or as the Jews would call it, the Shephelah, which are the lower coastal regions. Look at verse 9. Afterward, that is after the Battle of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country and in the Negev and in the lowland. The Negev is also, it's the Hebrew word for south. It's also the Hebrew word for desert, and refers to a semi-arid area south of Jerusalem. So after they defeated Jerusalem, they turned south. They go into the Negev and they engage the Canaanites there living in the hill country. And then they turn west to what is the Shephelah, the coastal lowlands, and they engage in battles there. Now, when you read this verse, it's kind of a general verse. It doesn't seem to say a lot, and there's a reason for that. The reason is that the story that we're reading about in these first nine verses is put on hold at this point until verse 16. So what happens at this point is there is a literary tool that is used in Judges, and I need to explain it to you because it can get confusing if you don't know this, and we'll see this and other places. There are times in the book of Judges when the author will put additional information in there that is out of sequence chronologically. Okay? Verse 10 does not follow chronologically from verse 9. What we have in verses 10 through 15 is a parenthetical section that's included to give us the background that we're going to need about Othniel when we get to chapter 3. So let me read verses 10 through 15, and I'll try to explain what's happening here. So this is a parenthesis. We've got a general introductory statement in verse 9, and then there's a parenthesis. Judah went against the Canaanites who live in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba. And they struck Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. Now Hebron is a place. Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai are people. They were leaders in Hebron. Then from there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I'll even give him my daughter Aksah for a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it, so he gave him his daughter Aksah for a wife. Now, verse 13, it is not possible to determine with certainty from the syntax either of the English or the Hebrew text whether Othniel is the younger brother of Caleb or whether Kenaz is the younger brother of Caleb. If it's Kenaz, which is what I suspect, then Othniel is Caleb's nephew. But either way, and I think the important thing here is that Caleb is one generation older than Othniel. Verse 14. Then it came about when she came to him, she being Aksah, that she persuaded him, that is her father, Caleb, to ask her father, she gets Othniel to ask for a dowry, basically, to ask for some land. And then she comes into the picture and alights from her donkey, and Caleb says, "What do you want?" And she says, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water." So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Well, this is a parenthesis that is actually telling us about two battles that occurred back in Joshua chapter 15. So we have an out-of-sequence area here. The reason for this is that Othniel is going to be appearing in Judges chapter 3. He is Israel's first judge. And it's important for us to understand the historical record so that we can see what his qualifications were for being a judge in Israel. And so we learn from this parenthesis that he has already distinguished himself in battle and that he is a relative, either the younger brother or the nephew, of one of Israel's great heroes, Caleb, of Numbers 13 fame. So I think we can conclude from this that the writer of Judges doesn't presuppose we've read Joshua. It's kind of an interesting thought. Otherwise, we would already have this information. So let's look briefly at these six verses. The campaign for the hill country is described in two phases, the conquest of Hebron and the conquest of Debir. Hebron, it says, was formerly known as Kiriath Arba. Kiriath Arba means either city of Arba, with Arba being a human being, or it could mean city of four, because Arba means four. As you haven't figured out this yet, Kiriath means village or town. So what we may have here is there may have been four villages that were in close proximity that eventually merged into one sort of metropolitan area, if you can think of it that way. According to Joshua chapter 15, verse 13, and verse 11 of chapter 21, Arba was the father of Anak, the ancestor of the Anakites. These were a race of giants that were known for their prowess in battle. The Anakites are mentioned several places in Deuteronomy, but specifically in the first two verses of Deuteronomy 9, they are described as a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, of whom you have heard it said, "Who can stand before the sons of Anak?" So these three leaders who were killed by Caleb, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, represent a race of warriors that historically had been formidable foes of the Israelites. He then moves on in verse 11 to the battle for Debir. Debir in Hebrew means word. It was formerly known as Kiriath Sefer. Now, that phrase means city of the book. So its newer name is Word. Its old name is City of the Book, which may imply that it at one time was the location of an archive of Canaanite literature. Maybe there was a library there of sorts. Then the account includes an anecdote that explains how the capture of Debir came about. As an incentive to capture the city, Caleb offered a reward to the one who could attack Debir and conquer it. And the reward is his daughter, Achsa. As I said, Caleb was one generation older than Othniel, so his daughter was of Othniel's generation and probably close to him in age. Othniel accepts the challenge, and he captures the city of Debir. Now, I think most of the women here today probably think that Achsa would be upset that she was given as a reward to the military man with the prowess to capture Debir. And there is a protest that's recorded here, but her complaint has nothing to do with any lack of egalitarian consideration. It also doesn't seem that she's in any way dissatisfied with Othniel. But she is upset that the land Caleb gave her is substandard. Now, when you read verse 15 in English, it kind of sounds like she says, you have given me the land of Negev. It sounds romantic. It sounds like a wonderful place. But here's what she really said. Since you gave me Negev land, I want some water and a blessing. This is not something she's happy about. So she needs this water because she needs to grow a garden to grow food for her family. And the blessing is traditionally something given by a father to his daughter upon her marriage. You can look in Genesis 24:60 and see Laban's blessing of Rebekah. Achsa must have known that there wasn't a lot of future in the Negev land. And if she and Othniel were going to do well and advance economically, it would be by the direct intervention of God, made certain, of course, by the blessing. I think we can be assured that when God puts a challenge before us, if that challenge is met in faith, there will be a reward for faithful service. But that reward may not be material in nature. It may not be immediate. It may not even come in this life. But there is reward associated with obedience. Prosperity theology is a heresy, but obedience always is the better choice, and God honors it. Now, look at verses 16 and 17. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms with the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad, and they went and they lived there with the people. Then Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they struck the Canaanites living in Zephath and utterly destroyed it. Sounds like they did it right there. They utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. So here we learn a couple of things. We learn about the settlement in the Negev and the second phase of Judah's conquest to the south. So we're back into the story that we put on pause in verse 9. We learn a little bit about the Kenites who had migrated to southern Judah. This information about the Kenites is going to be important in chapter 4. It's more important there, actually, than it is today's lesson. Now, I'm not 100% sure this is how this occurred, but from what I can tell, it seems that years earlier, before Moses had escaped from Egypt to Midian, that the Kenites, who were known to be a nomadic tribe, had migrated from Canaan southward into a place or region known as Midian. There they allied themselves with the Midianites, and when they did this, they, for all practical purposes, lost their Canaanite identity. Perhaps not completely, but they became part of the Midianite society. That's why Moses' father, Jethro, is referred to as a Midianite priest. They apparently had settled in Jericho after the Exodus. They'd come back in with the Jews, probably because of the relationship between Jethro and Moses. They had settled in Jericho, which is here called City of the Palms. And they subsequently then followed the sons of Judah southward to a place called Arad. It's the last part of verse 16 that I think is interesting. It says, the Kenites went to Arad and they lived with the people. That is, the Kenites lived in peace with the Jews. This sounds like a good thing, but it's actually a compromise. Israel is not carrying out the mandate to rid the land of the Canaanites. Beyond this, we also learn about the overthrow of the Canaanites at Zephath. In verse 17, the military campaign, which had begun in verse 4 and went through verse 9 and then was paused, it's resumed now. Zephath is the third city conquered by Judah and Simeon. Bezek and Jerusalem are the other two. Remember, Hebron and Debir were captured some number of years earlier by Caleb. After the battle, the city is renamed Hormah. It's a bit of a play on words in the Hebrew text, which simply reads, they utterly destroyed it and renamed the city utterly destroyed. That's what Hormah means. They utterly destroyed it and they renamed it utterly destroyed. In fact, the two words sound almost identical in Hebrew. In sacking Zephath, Judah and Simeon acted in obedience to the mandate. Now, the last two verses we're going to look at today are verses 18 and 19. Judah took Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country. This is interesting. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. After conquering the southern cities, the Israelites take Gaza and the coastal cities of Ekron and Ashkelon. We hear a lot about Gaza today, the city of Gaza and the Gaza Strip. It's an area along the Mediterranean that is controlled by the Palestinians, and it's the place from which Israel regularly is the recipient of rocket attacks. Ashkelon is on up the coast north of Gaza, and Ekron's a bit inland from Ashkelon. Verse 9 is a little bit of a surprise. Judah and Simeon were successful in the hill country, but they were not successful in the valleys. The verse explains the problem by saying, because they, that is the Canaanites, had iron chariots. Of course, chariots don't work real well in the hills, but they do just fine down in the valley. Up through 19a, the first part of verse 19, the campaign has been successful. And that success was the direct result, according to verse 19, of the Lord being with Judah. But in the latter part of chapter 1, verse 19, Judah encounters an obstacle, something we call the Iron Age. Have you noticed that charts, I'm beginning to not like charts. Charts tend to have this little vertical line, tiny little thing, and everything on the left side of the line is one way and everything on the right side of the line is the other way. Something ends and then something begins, like the snap of a finger. It's not really that simple in the real world. The Bronze Age doesn't just end at a vertical line on a chart and then the Iron Age begins. In this case, the Canaanites and later the Philistines clearly are working with iron. They have instruments of war made of iron, iron chariots. They have spearheads of iron, and they have chariots that are made of iron. While Israel's enemies clearly are living in the Iron Age, Israel is still in the Bronze Age. And this is a situation that's going to plague Israel through its conflicts with the Canaanites and also later on with the Philistines. There's an interesting passage over in 1 Samuel, verse 13, verses 19 and 20. Now this is later on. This is in the time of the Philistines, but listen to what this says. Now there was no blacksmith who could be found in all the land of the Israelites. For the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. So even years later, Israel is still living in the Bronze Age. They have to go and get services from the Philistines who are living in the Iron Age. So Israel was dependent upon the Philistines to sharpen their plows. On the other hand, while Israel is sort of inept in the use of metals, Goliath, we read in 1 Samuel 17:7, had a spearhead that's described as weighing 600 shekels of iron. Yet David defeated him with a rock. So you could say that when the Lord chooses to give victory, it doesn't matter if you're living in the Iron Age or the Stone Age. And conversely, when God chooses to withhold victory, there's nothing you can do to override his decision. Something must have happened that required the Lord to teach this lesson to Israel. During the campaign, the Israelites must have begun to think that their military success was due to their own superior fighting skills. Isn't that human nature? Well, it wasn't. In keeping the Jews in the Bronze Age, the Lord could demonstrate to Israel the error of their thinking. The object of their faith had become themselves. And the Lord made sure they understood that victory is in the Lord and not in fighting skills and weaponry. Psalm 20, verse 7 says, "Some boast in chariots and others in horses, but we will boast in the name of Yahweh our God." There are two things that kept Israel from finishing well: their failure to eradicate completely the Canaanites from the land, and the occasional belief that victory was a result of their own fighting skills and their weapons. One day, Saul will look at Goliath, and he'll see a giant of a man holding a spear made of iron. David will look at that same man and see an uncircumcised Philistine. See, David's the one who wrote those words in Psalm 20. "Some boast in chariots, some in horses, but I'll boast in the name of the Lord our God." He wrote that because he had proved this in his own experience. With a weapon directly from the Stone Age, David defeated a giant with weapons from the Iron Age. It hadn't mattered, because it's not about iron, spears, horses, or chariots. Well, Israel started well. They didn't finish well. As a result, the Canaanites reoccupied the cities Judah had defeated. And later, the Philistines will come on the scene with their iron weaponry. And what should not have been a problem will cost Israel many of their young men and ultimately their nation. There are a few better examples of lost opportunity than Israel. Unfortunately, beginning well and ending poorly is part and parcel of the human condition. I ran the White Rock Marathon once. I could never think of a good enough reason to run it again. I was really excited when the race began, and I was barely able to walk when it ended. You know, it's always the 15th round, the fourth quarter, the ninth inning, the 26th mile, when we learn things about ourselves we didn't know in the beginning. Paul knew this. Recall his words to the Galatian Christians: "Having begun in the Spirit, are you now perfected in the flesh?" One thing had marked their beginning. Another had marked their present spiritual state. And then in Galatians 5, Paul will ask, "What hindered you?" We're supposed to run the race with endurance. So how do we do that? We do it by keeping our eyes on Christ, the author and perfecter, the finisher of our salvation. As God's children, we're called heirs. Therefore, we share in his victory. It's not our own. It's a victory assured by him, not by us. This was Israel's failure. Let's not let it become ours.